Welcome to For Love and Music with Tara Joseph, as she explores the ever-changing music industry with today's top creatives, artists, and executives. Enjoy these fun and informative conversations with a little bit of love thrown in along the way.
Welcome to For Love and Music with me, Tara Joseph. Now, I do hope everyone is staying safe and healthy during these challenging times. So, who's on the show today? Well, all the way from Hawaii, but originally from Germany, let's welcome to the show Golden Globe-nominated composer Reinhard Hale. Reinhard, hi, how are you?
I'm good, thank you.
Hawaii. I'm sure all the listeners are desperately jealous. How did you end up there?
Well, first time I set foot on this island was in 1994. And I tried two islands, Kauai and the Big Island, and spent a week on each one and drove around a lot and experienced nature and experienced especially the crazy variety of climates and landscapes on the Big Island. And already stood there on some sort of mountain with cows grazing and snow, ice and snow, dead volcano in the background, which looked like Switzerland. And then I made a 90 degree turn and I saw the Pacific Ocean lying there. And that was such a unbelievably mind-blowing moment that I said, I think I want to live here one day. And then unfortunately, it took another 26 years, but finally I decided to take advantage of the pandemic, to be honest, which is not my usual thing, because I have seen quite a few big changes in the world, especially in Berlin in 89 when the wall came down, and I somehow never actually took any personal advantage of it. But in this case, I think I did, and I said, this is the chance. I think everything's going on Zoom now. Everybody's getting used to work on Zoom. I haven't really seen that many people that I'm working with. I'm seeing them only at the beginning of a project, and then everything is remote anyway. Even within Los Angeles, people don't see each other anymore.
That is absolutely correct. I never see anyone.
Yeah, so I might as well, right? So then I just, after only 4 years, put my house on the market and was able to sell it, because I think actually people have a higher appreciation for the home because they spend much, much more time there. They work from home, all of that stuff. So I think I had a home that kind of was suitable for that purpose and sort of the outskirts.
I'm so jealous. I have been to Hawaii a couple of times. I went to Kauai for my honeymoon, fell madly in love with it. And I know you're on the main island, right? I've said very many times to my wife that I could move to Hawaii. Seriously, it's just,
extra beautiful because it has these subtropical rainforests, which actually do exist here on the east coast of the Big Island as well. And it's basically the set for Jurassic Park. So,
goodness.
Yeah, it was bought in Kauai. So like all this, they didn't have to build anything. These waterfalls, there was no special effects. This is just like Kauai the way it is. It's amazing.
So tell me, how did you, because obviously I've read a lot about you and I know that you were there in Berlin when the wall came down. So, and I would love to hear more about that into the podcast. But how did you end up going from Germany to LA prior to obviously now being in Hawaii?
It has also personal reasons. In the 80s, I produced Nena's pretty big monster hit, 99 Red Balloons. And I was
a pop musician
and pop producer. And I had the opportunity to move to LA or move to New York, maybe move my business there. And I was invited to MTV Music Awards and I didn't go. And this all had personal reasons. I had a very sick girlfriend at the time. So that kind of kept me in Berlin. And I have to say, I really love Berlin. So, I mean, I still do. And it's kind of a hard place to leave. And then in the 90s, I married an American woman. And that was while I was still in Berlin. And she lived there for a while and then didn't really like it there anymore. And then I thought, maybe this is kind of a sign and I should go finally, because I've been sort of thinking about the US for quite a while.
So you moved for the same reasons as me, really, for love and music, hence the title.
Well, there you go.
We've got that in common.
But of course, I also was not a film composer at that time. I had literally just started to enter the field. So I had a slump of 5-6 years in the early 90s. and then hung out with actors and directors and started working for film just then in the mid-90s. And also met my business partner, Johnny Klimek. And we together met Tom Tykwer, and we did a bunch of really, really seminal movies with him. And that kind of even enabled the fact that I was able to set foot not only into California, but into the business, because I had neither did I have connections, nor did I have a track record. So it was kind of a really crazy move back in early 1997. And I moved, on top of all of that, I moved to Santa Barbara, which is ridiculously beautiful. But 2 hours away from LA is already too far to actually really make enough contacts to get into the industry. So luckily, we did only a year later, when I was already in Santa Barbara, we did the music to Run Lola Run, and that sort of started opening some doors.
I mean, already, just speaking then, naming the credits of some of the projects you've been involved with, extraordinary. But I do want to pull you up on 99 Red Balloons. Oh my God, that's one of my all-time favorite songs. And when I moved to LA, our next door neighbor was a German lady, and she thought that, I don't know whether it's she actually was, but she always told us that she was a pop star in Germany back in the 80s. She would sing 99 Red Balloons every single day, multiple times in the garage. Yeah, she'd sing it. So every time we drove in and out of our garage, she'd be singing in her next door garage, 99 Red Balloons, every day.
Well, I think maybe I would start with the therapy and then see if you find a decent drug.
It's so funny. Oh my God. She's moved now, so it's not such a part of our lives, but I love it every time it comes on the radio. So I'm very excited you produced it.
Tell me what her name was. You don't
Stephanie.
Have to do that. Stephanie?
I don't know. I don't know what her surname was.
Yeah, I don't know. It doesn't ring a bell. I mean, obviously, Stephanie's. I know tons of Stephanie's.
But listen, let's go way back to the beginning. So were you, I presume you were a musical child. I know you're a multi-instrumentalist. So when did you, all of this, you know, your musical career really take off? I know that you were in a very famous legendary German punk band, the Nina Hagen Band and Spliff. Just how did it all begin? How did that all start?
I was musical, but it was sort of, I don't come from a family that you would call Bildungsbürgertum, which is this German term, sort of educated middle class. It's kind of, they both are coming from both sides of my parents are from farmers. And my father was a craftsman. He was an electrician and built a business. And they were of this typical German war generation. You know, they were too young to be in the war. They were deprived of their childhood by the Nazi times, basically. They were born in 28 and 29. And they had their family in the 50s when everything was rebuilt. And their principle was, let's just try and make a better future for our children. It was this really selfless approach where I had the feeling they were deprived of their own childhood. And then they were just taking care of us for the rest of their lives and working their butts off. And I'm still flabbergasted because there was really not much of a selfish thing. They did get some sort of traveling during their retirement. But what they were doing, they were just enabling what any one of us wanted to do. And that included, in my case, they bought a simple piano and they gave me piano, or paid for piano lessons when I was 11. And of course, I didn't practice enough because I didn't come from that kind of educated middle class background where the parents are actually on your back, that you're actually practicing your music. So anything but a prodigy existence, really. But I learned everything by myself, just by improvising, listening to the pop music. I listened to the Beatles and the Stones and all that stuff, and had my own little band when I was 16 for the rest of my high school days, and then found a program in Berlin at the Academy of Music that was classical music production, where you didn't have to be a prodigy piano player or something. And of course, I was way too intimidated by the prospect of studying composition. Again, this has a lot to do with your background. You have to fight for everything, every little step. You have to discover yourself. You don't get any doors opened by anybody. And I mean, that was fine because they just barely accepted me into the music academy. And I started using this more or less as a means to an end. And the end was to play in a pop band and produce rock music or pop music. And I had kind of had that vision when I was 14, when I was listening to all this music. I've never told anybody about it. Very un-American. You know, in America, everybody broadcast.
Yeah, yeah.
This is my dream. This is my dream. And you're like, I don't want to jinx it. I'm just going to keep my mouth shut. Not even my parents or my siblings knew that this was, I literally had visions in my mind about being in the studio with a bunch of other guys or gals and making music and being on stage and playing for thousands of people. And about 10 years later, that was complete reality. And I had no idea how it happened. It was just this, I guess I automatically just kind of shifted in the right directions at the right moments. And then I was also lucky. And I kind of knew I had to go to Berlin and not to another town, because in Berlin was where it all happened. And you would inevitably meet people who would give you momentum, or just whether something would gel and come together and interesting stuff would evolve. That then happened a few years later in 77, when a guitar player who I knew said, there's this woman from who was like a dissident from East Germany, but she's an amazing vocal talent. And she was somewhat of a star for some easy listening pop music in the East. But now she's here in the West and she has a record contract with CBS Records. And she just came back from London. She hung out with the Sex Pistols, but she couldn't get a band together. So she's now back in Berlin and she's looking for musicians. So we started that band. We already had a record company because she had such star qualities. And we did two albums with her, and it was ridiculously successful because, again, also it was a really good band. But I mean, she was just an outstanding charismatic performer with ridiculous vocal capabilities, and she still is. I think she's like one of the most talented people I've ever met. So, and then I was still a student. I was still studying how to produce classical music, which of course included studio technology. And at the time, that it wasn't so as easy as it is now, because now you just buy yourself a laptop and a bunch of software and you have a studio and you can use it the way we use these ridiculously expensive big pieces of equipment in professional recording studios, where it was super hard to get in, cost a lot of money to get in there and spend time. And so, and you had to go through the system of A&R managers at record companies who would decide who is worthy to go to that studio and actually make some music. So those were crazy times. And now you have Bandcamp and you do your own album. Yeah. And you put it on Bandcamp. And yes, you cannot make probably millions on Bandcamp. So there's a difference.
You've been on an incredible journey. And as you were mentioning earlier, have worked on some extraordinary films. And you collaborated, you mentioned again, Tom Tykwer earlier in the conversation. And you worked on Run Lola Run with him, which is a brilliant film. You were nominated for a Golden Globe for Cloud Atlas. That's right, isn't it? And you
were... Yeah, that was the last project I did in that combo with...
Right. John and Tom. And did you work on Perfume as well, The Story of a Murderer?
Oh, yeah, of course. Yeah, everything
that,
in between.
Oh, my God, that's such a brilliant film.
16 years, we were basically
amazing.
A team. And then Johnny and I did other movies. We worked on Deadwood, HBO show. Like,
yeah.
That's something that's relatively well known. With it, The International, it's a political thriller, which I thought was a cool score. It was quite a range of styles, and it was kind of, that was our school in terms of how to score. And every time it was like another interesting challenge where we had the feeling we kind of needed to reinvent the wheel for ourselves. And it was very time consuming. It was never, this is what I liked about it, was that it was never following a typical method. This is how Hollywood does film scoring. But I have to admit that at some point, I found it a little bit too tedious. And I thought that we were not very productive. We weren't using our energy only for the creative side. And I kind of came around to the Hollywood method, how you make scores. You know, there are reasons why Hollywood scores are made in a certain way. And they are not all bad. I think the worst part of it is the temp music, where the editors just put music against the picture while they edit, and they take it from other movies. And that kind of becomes sort of a self, especially when filmmakers are getting used to the temp music and they basically tell you to imitate it. Then you have the feeling, you know, it all kind of goes round and round right. on the same kind of plane. And you, I mean, with a lot of film music, you see that. But every once in a while, you get some movies where somebody, and it's always the filmmaker who enables this, obviously. It's not the composer who can just say, oh, I'm doing something completely different. The filmmaker is not on board with that. Then you're either going to be fired or you have to do whatever they want. So sometimes stuff happens that's really awesome. Like, for instance, I like Dave Barrow and Ben Salisbury, two Brits. I don't know if you're familiar with those guys. I think when they score stuff, it's just completely outside of the realm of normal film scoring. And this is kind of what I love and what I would like to be.
So what's your process? So when you're asked to do a film score or a score for a TV series, are you given the scripts first? Are you given a synopsis? What's the process?
It's always different. I mean, it depends on whether you have an existing relationship with somebody. So if you have that, then they give you the script. Often they give you the script also when they are already way, way later in the process. They already have a rough cut of the film. And that's the kind of the typical Hollywood moment where they, as an afterthought, look for the composer or something. And then they send you out the script and they maybe, you know, if your interview goes well and your records are good and you get the job, then you're confronted with a cut from the film that actually has temp music in it. And that's, of course, that's what I was talking about. It kind of raises this issue where, like, how attached have people become to the temp score because they see it every day while they are working on the edit. So they hear this music with this particular picture, although it's not made for this picture, but they hear it about 1,000 times before you even have the chance to put your own version on it. And then they hear that one time, and they go like, yeah, we know it's not quite what we thought. And you're like, well, what you thought is the temp. Then you have to license the temp, which of course you don't want because you want something special. So it's sort of a contradiction in terms. Those are the worst case scenarios. And the best case scenarios are that you have a relationship with a filmmaker or a showrunner and they give you the script early on and they give you little scenes that they've put together and they have meetings and you have conversations and you talk about the subject matter and you talk about what point of view the music should take. Because the music absolutely, just like the camera, can take a point of view in each and every scene. Are we with this protagonist or that protagonist? Or are we changing it up in the middle of the film? And I think that's almost like the most important job of the film composer is to kind of support that. Which POV are we taking, you know? Or not always, it doesn't always have to be so on the nose. Or to just supply some backdrop of emotional ambiguity that the viewer can fill for themselves, where they can take a point of view, either one or the other. Like my older son always loved Darth Vader for whatever reason. And he's not
a musical, your son?
Both my sons are very, very musical. Okay. And they're both not musicians.
Are they living with you in Hawaii?
I wish. I guess they wish. They're coming for Christmas. But they're both in university. One is at UC Santa Barbara. The other one at Occidental College in Los Angeles. And actually, they're both not there right now. Of course, right. Because of COVID, everything.
Yes, of course.
Home. And so my younger son has, and four of his friends have rented an Airbnb in Colorado. So they have their own mini campus. I think that was a really good idea.
Yes.
They're kind of isolating there amongst the five of them so they don't
How lovely.
Yeah, it's a really cool idea. They're really close, pretty nerdy, all five of them, as far as I can tell. So, and my other son, I think he's suffering more. He's in Northern California where his mother lives. And he has friends there, but it's like for him, I think it's a little bit harder. So he can't wait to go back to Santa Barbara.
Right, right.
I guess in January, he's going to go back.
Oh, right. So one of your more recent projects, the Deutschland series, which I believe you can watch on Amazon Prime, was on Sundance TV.
It depends on which territory. It's really complicated.
Okay.
I can tell you exactly. I know that in the United States, first two seasons are on Hulu, and the third season is currently airing week by week, every Thursday night on Sundance TV in the US. So that's the situation for the United States of America. Germany, it's on Amazon Prime all the way through, and there is a whole slate of broadcast stations. Like Britain, I think it's Channel 4, unless it has changed, but I don't think it has. in France is Canal Plus. So there are all these broadcast stations that broadcast the first two seasons that currently or in the near future going to do a Deutschland.
Well, I'm glad that you explained that because now the listeners know where to find it, whatever country they are in the world.
That's right. You have to definitely look for it. It's in different outlets, but
the music is so powerful. So powerful.
I guess they let me. I guess they appreciate what the music does, or I don't know. I mean, it's a really, really pleasant collaboration that I had there. And I've never worked with the showrunners, Jörg Winger and Anna Winger. And they contacted me in late 2014, and they had just stopped shooting Deutschland 83 and sent me a few scenes. And I did a few layouts. And then on Christmas in 2014, they came to Los Angeles, and we spent a few days talking about the project. And the craziest thing about it was because I had lived through it, but I also lived 16 years in West Berlin when the wall was up all around it. And I'd literally lived scenes from the show myself. And I realized this is really, really well researched. I mean, Jörg is quite a few years younger than I, but he was in Germany. He was actually in the military in 1983, or like he was actually in the military in 1989 when the wall came down. They had these listening stations where they were listening to the Russians.
Oh my God.
And can you believe that they were spying on the Russians? And they had no idea that the wall came down. Somebody came running in and had watched television, just like every other German. And they said, the wall's coming down. You have to see it. And they were going like, what? They took their headphones down where they were listening to the Russians, spying to the Russians, trying to be ahead of the game. And they totally weren't, because the Russians didn't get it either. It was just such a crazy thing I think more or less a misunderstanding in communication internally in the East German administration led to the fact that they opened that one little gate. And then I guess nothing could be stopped anymore. It's actually explained in the show, in Deutschland 89. So the first episode starts with just that situation where the wall opens. And then the season unfolds from there, where basically everybody in the West and the East has to somehow reinvent themselves.
So are you, now that you've moved to Hawaii, are you working from a home studio because of COVID? Do you usually work from a home studio? What's your setup?
Yeah, I think I was a trailblazer. I put my home studio together in 1984. Pretty much been doing it since then. You know, right. I bought this is a 2-inch reel-to-reel machine. You know, then I bought a Fairlight and a big mixing board and everything. All of that was in my apartment. And that's all because I had success with my band Spliff. And then I had more success with producing 99 Red Balloons. So I had money. And I literally took a beautiful apartment in an old attic in Berlin and put a recording studio into it. And of course, the situation is very, very different. So if you, I can show it to you later.
Okay.
We're not doing the video. But I'm on a flower farm where there are two little buildings. And each building is basically just one and
a half. Is that the Airbnb you've rented, flower farm?
It's totally beautiful.
Oh, God, I'm so jealous.
It's a 4-acre property. It's manicured. There are palm trees. You have these bird calls in the middle of the night. You have crazy roosters that announce that they're open for business. And
I can actually hear the birds tweeting. I hope
he hears the cicadas. So,
is that cicadas? It's not birds.
The steady noise is the cicadas.
I'm sure I can hear tweeting.
Oh, yeah, tweeting that for sure. You can hear me tweeting about the election. Yeah, so it's totally nice. And then it doesn't have a lot of square footage, and I'm building a house. So we have just moved here 2 weeks ago, so we're pretty quick because we already have a property and we have a builder, and we're designing the house right now.
How long will it take?
That will take easily a year and a half.
Okay.
And we're hoping to stay up here. It's a little bit moist, but it's like 1,500 feet above the ocean. We have this panoramic ocean view, and it's...
I want you to show me before we jump off the call.
Yeah. And I'm currently, the container with all our stuff has come, and we had to put most of it in storage because these two little buildings that are connected are fairly small. I've extracted my core system, and I'm currently building it. from the ground up all by myself because I don't have any assistants with me. After 6 years, I really don't want to call him assistant anymore because he's so instrumental and wears so many hats that are so important for my work. And it's Paul Parker. And he, crazily enough, has just moved to Atlanta. So where he moved 3 time zones east, I moved 2 to 3 time zones west. So currently we have a 5-hour time difference. But
right,
he can still log on to my computer. So we're going to collaborate on setting up the system and kind of reinvent it a little bit. And also in projecting onto like how the new studio is going to be. But it's really not going to be your traditional recording studio with it hasn't been that in a long, long time. And it's really not necessary. So even if I record musicians or if I record myself, by the way, multi-instrumentalist is only on a film scoring level, which means you really don't have to be able to play these instruments. I'm a keyboard player and that's what I can play decently. And when I take a guitar in my hand, it's just a noise generator. I would not claim that. I play a bit. Percussion is okay, but...
Well, tell us, what advice would you give to any young listeners out there who are keen to become a composer? Any tips and tricks?
I would give parents the tip to not only give musical equipment to boys, but also to girls, because the process starts really early. And if you get into your 20s as a woman, and you go, I want to become a film composer, you are at a humongous disadvantage compared to all the guys who had like their first little drum computer and laptops set up by their parents when they were 13, and they were able to actually grow into that and learn the software, you know, learn this logical side of things in a very playful way, because the technology has become really, really important. I'm not saying that you can't write music with pencil and paper, but I would say that that is more or less than you're going to be confined to writing concert music. And I'm pretty sure that the actual concert composers also don't use pencil and paper anymore. I don't know. I mean, they're still around us. I'm pretty sure John Williams still does it. And then he has people with computers who do all the orchestration.
Yeah.
So in other words, getting that technology is now cheap. Don't spend all the time on TikTok. Actually, the same technology is used to make little TikTok videos. So there you go. Just kind of go a little deeper, have some musical training. And then, I don't know. I mean, it feels so strange to me because when I was of that age, high school and college, it was about being in a band so you could get the girls, right? You had to be in a band. And now people skip that stage because they realize there's really no money to be made to be in a band unless you're in the super, super top league, you know?
Yeah.
So it's kind of back to where it was, where only the really big superstars even get to make their albums. Of course, now you can make your album, but you can basically put it out for free. And then maybe Spotify is going to make more money than you will. So I think that's kind of the most important thing. And then, so like a lot of these people who say, I want to be a film composer during college years, they have to get into one of these programs. And there are tons of them out there. So there are so many more programs that will teach you film scoring. And I wouldn't know which ones are the best ones. I mean, Berkeley is still around. Columbia College is good. Of course, University of Southern California is sort of the most expensive. This is a private college, it's really expensive. And you have some professors that are already established in the industry, so people get their contacts there. So yeah, it does make sense to kind of study this properly, as opposed to what I did, and then hang out with filmmakers and score their movies for free. Hang out with film students, score their movies. Just score 30, 40, 50 little short movies, whatever it is. And that seems to me, because then not only are you honing your skills, but you're also developing relationships with people, some of which might actually have a career, and they bring you along. And as a composer, that's the most valuable thing, is to kind of be on a team with a really interesting producer, director who does good projects.
Well, Reinhold, it's been such a pleasure to talk to you. And as I said, incredibly jealous that you're living in Hawaii. If I come there on holiday, I will let you know. But thank you. Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
Thanks.
And yeah, I can't wait to see what the future holds, because you've had such an amazing journey to date.
Yeah, I'm not going to stop. It's going to have to be nature that stops me. So,
I think we've got many, many decades of you and new music ahead of us.
Yeah. Do the math and you will realize it's not that many decades. It's going to be decades.
Well, thank you. And thank you to all our fabulous For Love and Music listeners. You will be hearing from me again very soon. Stay safe and healthy. Bye for now.
Thank you for listening to For Love and Music with Tara Joseph. For more information, you can check out at For Love and Music Official on Instagram, at For Love and Music Official on Facebook, and also visit www.jamartistgroup.com/podcast.